the Monday Footy Review with Jimmy Bartel.
Bartel, clever! Brilliant! Unbelievable, actually. Jimmy with a bit of magic.
Well, if you win three premierships, you win a Norm Smith and a Brownlow medal, and you're very, very handsome. You get a great intro like that. James, good morning to you.
Thanks, Harf. Morning, everyone. This should be now known forever as Hutto Round 13. 13. Round 13.
Yes, it is round 13. It's almost finished too, Jim. It's almost finished. Not quite, though.
Yeah.
Speaking of almost finished, just digressing a touch. The Indy 500 is on at the moment. Did you know that? The Indy 500. And we're around about 160 laps into the 200 laps, so we're not too far off finishing according to the live blog that I've just tapped into. But I digress a little bit. Ramo, there was a photo tweeted out by Timmy Hodges, our good mate.
Yeah.
Timmy Hodges last night of an aerial view of the Indianapolis Speedway. And I saved it because I couldn't quite believe what I was seeing, that there is four holes of golf on the inside of the track at the Indianapolis Speedway. There's this beautiful aerial shot of this golf course on the top side of the photo anyway. There's 400,000 people in the venue, and there's four holes of golf on the inside of the track. It's quite remarkable.
Well, it looked amazing. So we'll get Joey to tweet that out on our handle, but that was absolutely amazing how that track looked with the 14 holes outside, the four holes inside. There's apparently a museum in the middle there somewhere as well, and it was just a beautiful photo, really.
Magnificent.
It used to be the case at Swan Hill that there was a golf course inside the racetrack at Swan Hill.
Is that right?
That is exactly right. It's not the case anymore, but it was the case. Hey, before we get to the footy, and I know we have to, but Curtis Luck is back leading
is he?
On the Korn Ferry Tour. So he's only got a couple of holes to play, and he is 11 under par. And there are 4 players at 10 under. Two of those have finished, and one of those is on the 17th, and one of those is on the 16th,
well,
along with Curtis.
Group.
So, yes. So it's up to him in a lot of ways. Probably be a bit unfair, but in a lot of ways it is up to him because he's got the lead with a couple of holes to play. So he did fall away from top spot, and he's been leading pretty much the whole way through after a first round sort of 68 and then following it up with a 66. So going into the weekend, he was in front. Can he hold on? We'll find out in the next sort of half hour or so.
Well, he's birdie 15 and 16. Yeah, he was two over after 14, and now he's even through 16. So that's got him back to the lead. And the other
birdie
guys
glass
on the top.
Two.
Yeah, other guys at the top have had some incidents on the way in. So good luck, Curtis. See what I did there? Okay, let's get to the footy before I make any more bad jokes.
It's Monday at 7. You're off.
How good is that, Jim? Just because it's Monday doesn't mean you can't be sharp, Jim. You've got to be sharp on a Monday.
You're up looking and about. Sharp with your turtleneck on.
It's not a turtleneck. It's a warm...
It's a turtleneck.
What's it called? It's a puffer. No, it's not a puffer. It's a fluffy... Yeah. What do they call that stuff?
Fluffy, that polar fluffy, fleece.
Polar fleece, that's what it is.
Yeah, very Cluedo-like you look, but keep going.
Jim, give me your number one takeaway from round 13 of the AFL to this point in time.
I think we have to probably discuss a bit of the Dogs' demons for me. And I know all of us like to say, who does it say more about? I know we discuss that a bit. And I guess that was the question that I couldn't quite answer, so I thought, well, on Monday, let's turn to the brains that we have here in White, Ramanaskis and Harford. Who does it say more about? Because we're talking about the Dogs and their emphatic win against the Crows, whether that was a good sign that the Doggies were back and their midfield were, as Rama, you highlighted, completely dominant. As far as midfield groups dominating an opposition, I know the Crows are naught and 1,000 this year and don't look up to the standard. But when you have that such dominant performance, you've got to acknowledge it. So it showed to be good form for the Dogs. But does it say more about the Dogs with Aaron Norton, even though he was well held, but just at least having him part of the forward structure and their huge midfield? Or does it say more about the Ds just failing again, sort of at a bit of a, you call it a litmus test?
Well, I always thought that was the Demons' form a bit of fake form. They beat North Melbourne, they beat Adelaide, then they beat a very depleted Collingwood. So it was the test that probably separated, I think, the two teams. And in the end, there's a bit of wind around on Saturday at Metricon Stadium, but the third quarter dominance of the Bulldogs was evident for all to see. They didn't get much out of Norton, or they didn't get much out of Bruce, but when they went inside forward 50, it was easy for them. Melbourne never really got going through the midfield through that whole game. Bruce was dominant in the ruck. Like, amazingly, the Bulldogs played Tim English as a permanent forward in the second half because they couldn't ruck him anymore because Bruce was so dominant in that game. So Josh Bruce was rucking. Josh Dunkley was in the ruck at some time. And then Tim English stayed forward. But I think in the second quarter, the Demons came out and gave a little bit, Whitey. But other than that, Whitey, I thought the Bulldogs really controlled that game almost from start to finish.
I think, Jimmy, personally, it said more about Melbourne because the Dogs played at a level that you would expect when they've got their best team in. You know, their midfield is very strong, and at the moment, a lot of their midfielders are playing very well. But it showed Melbourne still has this issue around consistency of effort week in, week out, and within a game. So we saw samples of Melbourne playing really well, but it just seems, and again, I'm not the expert, but it just seems whenever you think Melbourne's clicked, they think they've clicked, and they drop away. They haven't got a sustained effort of effort. And I just feel they get ahead of themselves, both within a game, but also if you take a wider lens on their season.
Yeah. I was really disappointed, Jim, in the D's.
Can I just jump in there on the back of Whitey's point? I never sort of question Melbourne's effort because they constantly build their game around contested footy and clearances, but that's hard to sustain that pressure. And we saw that probably with, remember when the Saints just missed the eight probably 2 years ago, and it was all off the back of just energy, 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 energy. And you can't do that. Like, but not only you can't do it for four quarters because the opposition will come at you and you just can't sustain it, but you can't do it throughout an entire season, especially the season we've got where, you know, short backups and things like that. It's what is actually their layer of football off the back of the energy. The energy should be a given, you know, that contested football, outnumbering, defensive pressure. You should expect that, but it's what is the actual football away from that. And again, for me, it just, whether they address it with drafting, free agency or coaching, it's the polish and the system away and around those contested situations still for me, for Melbourne.
Well, that's what we highlighted in that third term, Rama. They're 7 points up at three-quarter at halftime, the D's. Now, they're going into the wind in the third quarter, but would have had it in the last. And at one stage, I think the way that the Bulldogs transitioned the ball from the back half, I mean, Crozier and Johannesson and Daniel in that third term did as they pleased, Rama. I think it was one stage, it was seven inside 50s for the Dogs in that third term, and they'd kick six goals. Like, it was just open up, just open the gate and said, "There you go, boys. Take all the space you like, and we'll just let you run through." It was a very odd third quarter from the D's after having that lead at halftime, working so hard to get that lead, Rama.
Well, the D's actually had more inside 50s for the quarter, but it was six goals, one to three behinds, I think, for the quarter. What Jim's talking about is around that contest, Melbourne will never ever be questioned.
Yeah.
But then you look at uncontested football, Jim. It's plus 40. Mm. In the Dogs' favour, Melbourne just get themselves into tangles when the ball gets outside the contest because it's not one player running free, it's then the chain that the Bulldogs are able to create on the outside that has Melbourne just going scratching their head. I was watching that game on Saturday, going, hang on, where's the Melbourne player here? The Melbourne player should have got across. The Melbourne player should have squeezed up. They shouldn't be able to move the ball. Like, there was a real slow play through the Bulldogs' back line. It was a simple one switch of the football, and then three Dogs players were out on the outer side of the ground. And I'm sitting there going, that can't happen. That's just the structure thing.
Yeah, so spot on, Rama. And the thing with it's 2 points that is, and we're both saying it, is Melbourne almost play contested footy, but then their structure away is to play more contested football, whereas the Dogs, when they play their contested football, is to get those likes of Crozier, Johannesson, Daniel, the footy on the outside that you're touching on, get the ball into McRae, swinging out to his left. It's a system to allow you to play your game style. So, whereas at the moment, we 100% agree. Melbourne, yeah, they'll have a crack and they'll win contested footy, but what is it leading to? So all the opposition when they plan for Melbourne is, we don't have to beat them, we just have to match it. Because if we just match them in that contested situation, our system outside of it is going to be better.
I think there's been an adjustment too from the Bulldogs with the way they move the ball.
So against the D's then, to everybody, are you better off setting up better behind the ball? Almost go, well, if we can break even at a contested with contested football with the D's, we're going okay. But if they kick it to us behind the football, we can then start move the ball on the outside and we're going to get the D's that way?
Yeah, well, I know in my time at Geelong, when you played sides like that, it was just so heavily contested focused. You still had to match them because of the territory battle and you don't want them to get their tails up. But you could sort of start to position... Your wing could just come a little bit off. Your halfback can come a little bit more corridor because, you know, if you apply enough pressure at the source, you force that quick kick, you know, and you see the opposition defenders, they just start to wait for it. Like, that's all they want, it come in slow. But because they've got so many trapped, use the example, say it's on the half-forward flank for Melbourne or near the logos, they then, you know, they scrap, they fight, they do that really well. They dump it in. This has always been the case with Melbourne. They'll get a lot of inside 50s, as we're talking about. But they'll dump them in, but then the rebound comes out to the open side. And if you did a freeze frame, you've got trapped of probably 12 Melbourne players all caught around near the logo on the opposite side of the ground. So the opposition then starts playing three quarters of the field with seven players. That is almost impossible to stop. That's why they get scored a lot against. They win the initial contest, turnover, rebound.
Yeah. Yeah, and the Doggies took full advantage of that. You look at their key players. McRae had 17 uncontested, Smith 17 uncontested, Hunter the same, Bontempelli 15, Johannesson 18. And that's what I think the Dogs have done a bit better in the last month or so. It's been able to get their good players on the outside and in space. And going forward, they've been a go-forward team in the last little while, as opposed to having heaps of touches in close, which is what they've been known for. Now they're expanding and getting forward, and they've got good players, Whitey, getting their hands on the footy going forward.
Lockie Hunter makes a massive difference to that half with the way he plays. He's such a clever player. He uses the ball well, but even the shape that he creates with how he plays, I think he makes other players better as well. And I think, you know, he's obviously a very, very good player, but I think he makes a lot of difference out there.
But I did see this game as a battle for the position that both of these guys are on the ladder. Like, I don't see these guys being better because they're 1-11 versus top 8 sides for the year.
Yeah, I think the Bulldogs can be better still. I can see why you'd say that, but I think with Norton now back into the team, that straightens him up again. He will start to get a lot more one-on-one contest. Last week against the Crows, well, let's not worry about that. But even though Stephen May beat him on the weekend, he was still able to create contests at ground level. He was still able to create Mitch Wallace getting a lot of one-on-one contest himself. And Mitch Wallace is absolutely brewing inside forward 50 as a one-on-one play. He kicks four on the weekend.
Love it.
Whitey's right. They haven't had Lockie Hunter for a lot of the season. He comes back in now. He adds another difference. He adds more width to that team, the way he plays the game. I don't know. If the Bulldogs continue on this roll, this type of form, they'll worry a couple of teams in September.
They're an interesting one, the Dogs, because they are 7-6 and they currently sit 7th on the table. They've got Geelong and West Coast in their next two. So based on where things are at, they kind of need to win at least one of those. They've got Hawthorn and Fremantle after that. So they've only got four games to go because they've also got the bye. So it's a little bit inflated where they sit on the ladder at the moment because they've played more games than some of the other teams. But if they're going to be a finalist, they've got to find a way to beat a team inside the top eight because they haven't really done that at any point this season. In fact, they haven't.
And that's a bit of my point. Where they sit on the ladder, I think, is sort of where they deserve at the moment. And waiting to see them, perform, but more perform well against one of these top sides. It's not necessarily the win I'm looking for. It's the performance against them. And look, to use the pun, I was bullish on the Bulldogs at the start of the year. I thought they were going to be maybe. I had them sitting fourth at the end of the home and away season because I thought they addressed a couple of their areas. Whereas bringing in Bruce and Keith, a key forward, key defender, because we know they got midfield depth. And you have a look at that midfield; they are in that peak of their powers age bracket.
See, the gut feel on the Dogs half is that you look at them and they're in the eight, obviously, but I kind of feel like they're better than Collingwood and at least level with St Kilda, maybe better than St Kilda. And I reckon if they played Port Adelaide and Brisbane on neutral territory, there'd be a great chance as well. But they've lost to all of those teams through this season, and that's why they're teetering.
Yes, they are. All right, but they got the job done, the Dogs, in the weekend. The D's disappointing in that third term, and the Doggies took full toll, which is what good teams do. Let's move on to one of the games yesterday with Brisbane and St Kilda. Now, this was litmus tests before, Jim. This was a litmus test for the St Kilda Football Club, and they fell short by 2 points, but I don't think they lost any admirers with how they went about it, Jim. They worked really hard. In fact, they should have probably won in the last quarter. They dominated possession and opportunity in the last term, but just failed to hit the scoreboard after Jack Billings kicked that ripper from the pocket for the only goal of the quarter. What did you make of the Brisbane Lions and St Kilda clash?
Yeah, well, you guys know I'm a positive guy and I like to focus on the winners a lot, but I actually have come out with a bit more positives with the Saints and I have more concerns with the Lions. And I think we've touched on this a bit. We feel like they're one short everywhere, and my worry is going to big finals. You look at all the good sides. So I think we're pretty comfortable with Geelong, West Coast and Richmond as sort of being the premiership favourites. But you have a look at what they got forward of the ball. So big Tim Tam, Tommy Hawkins, West Coast. You got Darling, Allen, Kennedy, some other 10 kids they've got out of the waffle who can all play key forward. They've just got a huge list of them, the Eagles. And then Richmond, obviously, you've got Rewalt, Lynch and Martin. Now, it seems like Brisbane have got all mid-size flanker types in their forward line. So Eric Hipwood, even though we sort of put him as a tall forward, he's not a tall forward. He's a tall flanker, second, third forward because of his body shape and the way he gets the footy. And that's just still my concern with the Lions coming into a big finals. We saw it when they lost to the Giants. They just kept peppering away. They had no one really who could take a mark. So the Giants, the final series last year, they were able to just keep intercepting and hanging on. Unless their midfielders and small forwards just hit the scoreboard a lot, I have some concerns for them, and I still took that away from the Saints game.
Yeah, it's a good point because you look at Brisbane and you go, I'm not sure there's somebody there every week that can kick three goals.
Yeah.
You need that a guy that you can go, yep, he's going to kick three or four. Charlie Cameron's probably the obvious one, but he's that small forward or smaller forward that you're talking about, Jim. So that consistency in scoring is a concern. But the inaccuracy now, what is it? Eight out of their last 11 games or something like that. They've kicked more behinds than points now. Yeah. I don't know. Is it mental? Is it technique? Is it it's probably a combination, but it's hurting them now. It really is.
Just quickly, Curtis Luck has won on the Corn Ferry Tour. He's got
fantastic
up and down from the bunker on the last hole to win by a shot. So fantastic win for Curtis Luck. Jimmy, I'm a bit like you with St Kilda. I mean, we know of St Kilda have been this free-flowing team that can score quite heavily and be really attacking and beat teams that way, but they actually matched it with Brisbane in the toughness stakes. And while Brisbane, they had missed opportunities and maybe they should have won by more, in a lot of ways, I have a bigger respect for St Kilda, even though they didn't win the game, based on their ability to play well differently, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Whitey, just wait. So you expected Brisbane to be tougher than St Kilda?
Yeah, I thought Brisbane would win easily yesterday.
No, but I'm talking about the toughness stakes. Do you think Brisbane is a tougher team than St Kilda?
I think Brisbane's one of the toughest teams in the competition to beat. You've got to play well to beat them. You've got to match them in the contest and all that sort of thing. I see St Kilda more as a team that can run and gun and hit the scoreboard and do it that way. I think they've improved as the year's gone along, but under Brett Ratten, they're a very different team to what they were when they were at their best under Alan Richardson, which was all about pressure.
Yeah, well, and I thought they should have won the game, as I mentioned before, that they had so many inside 50s in that last term, and they just lacked the poise, I think, Rama and Jim, that good teams would have found a way through the numbers in that forward half of the Saints in that last term, but they just kept hacking the ball back in to the hotspot, to the numbers, and it was all scrapped from there, and the Brisbane Lions were able to just own the ball every now and then and just stop play. But I thought Brisbane, under that pressure, Rama, which was probably the takeout for me, I must admit, under that pressure in the last term, they seemed to really second-guess themselves and question themselves about whether or not they could go to the other end and score. They refused to almost try. It was really safe and negative. Yeah. And I know they had the lead and they were trying to save it, but they didn't move the ball with any fluency or aggression at all in that last term. And I thought, gee, they put themselves under pressure on the back of it.
So Brisbane needed to score, obviously, and they weren't really trying to. There was a contest on centre wing where Zach Bailey probably won the game for Brisbane, where he's able to win it. Ball goes down the other end. They're able to lock the ball. But just that point that you make, and Jim, this is the interesting part. When teams are chasing late in games, and St Kilda were chasing hard, obviously, that hack kick that you talk about, that's where you need players with a lot of composure.
Yep.
Because a number of times around that 50 to 70 mark, you just saw just players just jamming it on the boot. You know, Harris Andrews coming across, Darcy Gardner coming across Smoyley. Jared Berry had put himself back into the dangerous spot. He's coming across to the spoiling. What St Kilda actually needed to do, and this is the hard part, because you don't have your runner coming out, so you don't have your runner in your ear saying, there's 3 minutes to go, there's 2 minutes to go. You know, you because you're in that mindset, I've just got to get the ball in because the siren's going to go, you lose the composure. So what St Kilda actually needed to do is they needed to take the ball from side to side from their 50 to try to shift Brisbane's defenders from side to side to pick a hole. But because they had no idea of the time on the clock, which is a great thing, mind you, they just kept just jamming in there high, and it was too easy, really, for the Brisbane defenders.
Yeah, and I'm glad you raised that point, and I've sort of learned off the great Daniel Harford is segues. He's the king of segues. So I think that point you raised there is a good segue, I think, into the Giants West Coast game, because it's going to highlight the point for me, which is football IQ and understanding details in the game. And you mentioned the Saints. Yes?
I want you to hold that.
This is radio craft 101. Wow. Jeez.
I want you to
hold
that.
You've got your Cluedo turtleneck on and you're preaching.
It is a beautiful segue into the Giants and the West Coast Clash.
Good man.
And we're going to focus on that game after the break. And the Monday Footy Review, Jimmy Bartel is our specialist. And he loves a bit of radio craft. And he'll come back and give you all his best after this.
The Breakfast Club.
Can't question the boys' effort. I think the concentration to give up patches of play, I mentioned the first quarter and then late in the third when they probably scored three in a row. You add that up together and, you know, we probably controlled the game for large periods of it. But I can't question their effort. Concentration levels need to be spot on, especially when you're playing a side like the Eagles who are, you know, clearly, you know, one of the premiership favourites. So effort good, but execution got better as the game went on, but cost us early.
Cost us early, says Leon Cameron, coach of the Giants. They were down by 12 points in the end to the West Coast Eagles yesterday at the Optus Stadium in Perth. Concentration, footy IQ, Jim, is that where we're leading with this conversation before the break?
100%. That is the first time I've heard Leon's comments. I didn't hear his post-match presser or interview afterwards, and that was my takeaway from watching my Giants play, is just attention to detail. Detail is what sort of hurt them in the end. Now, let's not take anything away from West Coast. We saw some dominant games from some champions of the game. Nick Danui's first quarter was ridiculous. I thought the TV had the stats wrong. I went, "Well, was that from last week?" And then it just said first quarter. It was 8 hit-outs to advantages, 6 clearances. I'm like, my hat, how are you supposed to stop that? And then big gecko hands McGovern, the best game wrecker in the business, had 10 intercept marks. And this is what I was leading to is, Rammer touched on it with the Saints. If you're a forward group and you realise this guy, you probably notice after probably his third or fourth, he's having a good day. If the midfield group is just banging on the boot under extreme pressure, stop leading. Like, yeah. If you're his direct opponent, there's no need for you to lead up. Let others do that. So Jake Riccardi, in his first game of footy, was fantastic. He was fine. Keep leading up because his direct opponent was going with him. But the direct matchup for McGovern, he's going to take you the footy. Just play back shoulder or stand there and body him up and get yourself in the game. You mightn't mark him, but at least bring it to ground and keep yourself in the game. So it's just, Leon touched on it, Leon Cameron, just concentration and attention to detail hurt the Giants last night.
So this is, again, a little bit of the runner not being able to go out there. Like if you're Leon Cameron in the box in those last couple of minutes, you're getting the runner straight out there to whoever Jeremy McGovern's playing on and just say, take him to the behind post and stand there. Stand behind it so he can't go anywhere near the football, because in the end, here was the difference. What did he take? He took 4 marks in the last couple of minutes, I think, half, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yep.
And that's so the game.
So you can still get involved. It doesn't mean completely negative. But Himmelberg's last mark, which I think it got him to with about 12 points, when he backled, that you can take that position and still get those, but your starting point's got to be closer to McGovern. And sides who have had a little bit of success against McGovern, there's not many because he's been pretty much all Australian every year he's played a full year, but the sides that have managed to kick goals on him or have an effect, they play back shoulder on him. I know sides have used sort of smalls or their second or third tall, because back shoulder, then you can at least track him to the footy, and if he goes for the mark, you can spoil it. But if the midfield wins the footy and gets a little bit of ground, like that Toby Green kick to Himmelberg, you can duck out the back and find some space on him.
So, Jimmy, I'm interested in your thoughts. I've been dying to ask you this since the game last night.
Uh-oh. He's had a sleep on it. He's ready.
Yeah, no, I have. So they didn't win the Giants, but they did come from over 5 goals down to get close towards the end. And when they had to go fast, they did. And we've been bemoaning the fact that they haven't gone quickly really at any point throughout the course of this year. Now, while it didn't work and they did kick it a little bit towards McGovern at the end, they did kind of scare the Eagles a little bit. Do you think that sort of unlocked the Giants a little bit and they can take that now into next week? And would there be a couple of other teams now going, oh, geez, we didn't really want to see the Giants play like that in the last quarter?
I hope so. Sometimes you just need to see it to believe in it. And I think early in the game and different patches, you could see there's still a bit of confidence factor at play when they did win the footy back across half-back. They found, you know, say, Whitfield or somebody else for that first release kick, and they were still, you could see a bit of confidence still wasn't quite there in the group. They went back slow off the mark. But when their hand was forced late in the game, you could just see the overlap run and you know, make something happen on the move. I hope they really do bottle that as a playing group and go, right, we're going to rattle off the next 4. But opposition, what's that, Rama?
Well, we say this week in, week out, though, about teams when they're chasing, they play their best football. So, like, I get you can't do it the entire game, but there's got to be periods in the game where you play that style of football, you play that attacking brand, you play that up-tempo style of game. Like, obviously, the start of the quarter is probably the most obvious time to do that, but I see it week in, week out with teams playing safe, 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 and then they start to chase and they play their best style of football and everyone goes, well, why can't they do that for 4 quarters?
Yeah. It frustrates me as well. But I just want to say this on the Giants. We know West Coast. They've won a number of games in a row, 7 or 8 games in a row. They now go to Queensland for the next 4 weeks. So that's the challenge for the Eagles, is to play well away from Perth, because they've had this great run at home and they've won all their games. They can't do any more than that. But the Giants are interesting. We talked about the Bulldogs being 7 and 6. They've only got 4 games to go, with Geelong and West Coast in the next 2 weeks. The Giants are 6 and 6, with Fremantle, Carlton, Adelaide, Melbourne and St Kilda to come. My point is, if the Giants play like they did in the last quarter over the next 5 weeks, they will make the finals and they will be dangerous. But they've got to play like that and not the rubbish that they served up in the first quarter where they couldn't score because they were paralysed trying to move the ball.
Yeah, and just going back to your point, Rama, as soon as sides actually understand what seems like risky ball movement, if everyone's on the same page, it's not that risky. Because if everyone is on the same page and knows, like if I know, Rama, you're going to mark the footy, anytime you mark the footy, you're going to play on and make your move or make your decision, forwards know straight away, Rama's moving, so they start leading that way, which actually creates the outnumber to cover up any errors. So whenever the really good sides, they make heaps of turnovers, but the thing is they're predictable in turnovers, so you can just keep buttering up the turnovers. When we played that fast, high possession game at Geelong, they just kept going. Why didn't the actual time that you'd get, you know, whacked around the ears from the coaches is when you didn't go, because everyone you're throwing everyone else out of sync. It's but sides nowadays, they play a lot of risk adverse footy, safe, but that actually traps you in because the opposition gets set up.
Yeah, and it's causing problems for a team like the Giants. And you're right, Whitey. The last five rounds are very, very fair for the Giants. That if you'd like to be a Giants player, if you had a season
form
on the
ladder.
Line,
this is a shoehorn into a form ladder.
Well, it's not actually because I haven't updated it over the weekend. Sorry, but it opens up. And Freo, Carlton, Adelaide, Melbourne, St Kilda. It's as good as you can get in the back five rounds.
It's up to them.
Of a season.
Because so not only are they playing teams below them. Sorry, Daniel, but not only are they playing teams below them, but they're playing teams around them. So they, if they're good, and we think they're good, but they're not playing very well, they'll knock out teams around them as well as beat teams below them. It's
I'm
up to them.
I'm not convinced they're good
well,
at this stage.
Well, we'll find out, won't we? Because they'll either win them and they'll be good to very good, or they won't win them and they'll be average and they'll be hell to pay because they should not be missing the finals with that list.
Well, we'll see. We'll see what the football director does about that at the end of the season with his board members, if we know we can get in contact with him. Let's have a look at one of the other games across the weekend. Let's go to Dreamtime on Saturday night. We spoke about a few issues earlier this morning. It was 12 points in the end in favour of the Tigers. They dominated proceedings, 10-13 to 10-1. Great kicking by the Bombers in the end. And 12 points. They came back late to the Bombers with a late surge, Jim, but it was a really dominant performance from Richmond everywhere else apart from the scoreboard.
Yeah, I don't know whether you guys discussed this earlier. Quick straw poll, Dreamtime game, Darwin?
Yeah, we're all for it.
All right, cool. Yeah. Cool, I'm all
we
for
loved
it.
Loved it.
I think that's what that game's about, so you should put that game where, you know, what it represents, which is the top end and the contribution of Indigenous players to the game. But, look, if Essendon supporters just think it's only those two free kicks that cost them, you got to dig a bit deeper. They were absolutely beaten across the field. They didn't have a single tackle inside forward 50, and it was the inside 50 differential was plus 42, I think, in the end.
Correct.
So we were playing a bit of half-court footy. There, where you just bring it out to the 50 and you play again. It seemed like that a lot of the day. But, Rama, I know we've discussed your Bombers. They're caught so far in between of, you know, you go back 18 months, that their one was that rebound off half-back, playing to their strengths, and it looks like they've gone too far the other way and trying to correct it. But the Tigers, they're just doing enough, and I think that's the worrying thing. I think for you mentioned Whitey, opposition or what's coming is the Tigers aren't hitting full steam yet, but they're still finding ways to win. So I guess that's a sign of their professionalism. But Rama, your Bombers, do you last few rounds? Do you make personnel changes or do you make positional changes? Because
they haven't got the personnel, Jim.
But you've got to find something, don't you? Do you start playing players in spots that are going forward? Because they've clearly pointed to that they can't make any adjustments to game plan this year because they had all of summer to start putting things in place. We're 13 rounds in and we're still no clearer of what the transition is.
Yeah, I think the positional changes is more than likely.
they don't have the because they've still got a number of injuries to probably key personnel. We discussed that last week, but you know the game on the weekend, Essendon folded back. They wanted to try turn the game into this dour affair where they just had so many numbers in Richmond's forward 50 that they couldn't score. Richmond was still good enough to have 23 scoring shots in the game. But, yeah, you're right. It was a half-court football. Essendon would win it across half-back or inside their defensive 50, kick it up in the air. Vlosten would mark it. Grimes would mark it. You know, whoever was there for the Tigers, rebound it back in, kick it, you know. I felt sorry for Tom Lynch and Jack Riewoldt in the end because, you know, they were really never looked like a chance because they were double and triple teamed all night. Essendon were only ever going to score on some sort of rebound if they could almost fluke it and get it over Richmond's defence and get moving that way. The momentum killer for Essendon was the tip and Woody goal, which was not allowed, which Grimes has now been fined for staging. Essendon did have some sort of momentum going there.
No doubt.
And I just wonder, you have to wonder if what happens if that goal is allowed and what happens the remainder of the game. But I didn't think Essendon deserved to win. But what I do know now is Richmond have found another genuine midfielder. Shea Bolton is a genuine midfielder for the Tigers.
He's a jet.
Yeah, they've been looking for one, and with Edwards not being up in the hub just yet, he's the one that's really benefited from Matt because of the minutes that he's now played in the midfield, he will be a starting midfielder. It'll be Martin, Cochin, and probably Bolton that will start in their centre square. And then you've got, you know, the likes of Jack Graham who can come in and play more as a defensive style of mid. So that's really important for the Tigers this year.
Would you take Jack Graham at the Bombers? He looks like the type of player that the Bombers need.
No.
They want him. Wow. Don't they want him? Wasn't there some feedback last week that they're in the hunt for Jack Graham?
The problem is, and Whitey and I were throwing a few text messages around Saturday night, it's just Essendon's midfield looks...
I can imagine the content.
Yeah.
Well, it was no emotion, actually. It was just... It is what it is. Essendon's midfield just looks small. Like, you know, Zach Merritt is just... He's trying his absolute heart out. I love Zach Merritt and how he's played this season. He's, you know, his run, for one, is still been there, but he's around the contest, he's absolutely worked his backside off. But he just needs help. He needs bigger mids in there to help him, Whitey.
Yeah, so you've got Zach Merritt, Andrew McGrath, and Dylan Shield. They are their leading possession winners this year, but they're all the same. And when you throw in also Darcy Parrish, a bit the same again. They're small, they're good players, but they're small. And they don't have that bigger body midfielder, and that's why there's obviously been that link to Jack Graham, but Jack Graham doesn't get enough of the footy. They need a pivot-type player in that midfield group, and they don't have it.
But he doesn't get much opportunity, Jack Graham, to play inside mid.
No, I understand that, but my personal view is he's not that player. They actually need to invest in a really good player. And if that's part of... They get emotional talking
you're
about
emotional
this.
Again, you're so emotional.
But if they are serious, and if they do lose Joe Danaher, well, then they've got to invest in a star player in that role. Because otherwise, they're just going to be a team. Because they're too similar. So I've got a question for you, the three of you. The style that Essendon is trying to play at the moment, is that a good style? Is that going to win them finals, or is that not a good style?
Oh,
with the
I must
players
admit,
they've got particularly.
I must admit, I actually don't know what they're trying to do.
No.
I have no read. It seems to be all over the shop for me. They're a muddling team, the Bombers. I think I might have said this on Friday. I said it somewhere anyway. They're a muddling team. They're middle-of-the-road muddling team. I don't actually know what they're trying to do. I mean, they had 313 disposals on the weekend, whatever it was, and had 22 inside 50s. What is that? What is that? I know Richmond play good press and they defend really well. I understand all that. But if you have 300 disposals, you've got to be getting the ball inside 50 more than 40 times. You just have to. No, I don't see how that doesn't happen.
Yeah, I just think that the style, for me, half, and we touched on, you know, the inside mids, but it just looks suited to trying to play with their strengths, which is their defensive group, and you get numbers back. So, but the problem is, once you win it, you've got no structure to kick it to.
Yeah, that's the problem. Like I said this last week, I feel Essendon were at their best when they attack, when they play enterprising, daring football, because they've got those type of players when they have full personnel out there. You know, McKenna, Saad, real attacking off halfback, Fantasia, Tip and Woody forward. You know, creative, instinctive type players. Even Dylan Scheel and Merritt, when they do get the ball and are able to burst, you know, it causes confusion for defenders up the ground. So it helps their forward, but right at the moment it just feels like they're trying to take the game down to like an NBA game almost. Yep. We'll sort of hold and take the game deep and see what we can do in those last couple of minutes and see if we can win it. Now, that may be due to what personnel they've had out on the field over recent weeks, but I'd be surprised if that was the formula going forward, and particularly with an ex-teammate of mine, Blake Carosella, who was such an attacking player when he played the game, and he's guiding the midfield and ball movement at the moment. I don't think that's what he would want because of the way he played the game.
I'd love to see Essendon next year with they've got some talent, and especially in their back half, but instead of them getting all their possessions and using all their talents in the back 50. I think when we see Essendon going well, I'd love to see him rammer, you know, Saad, getting lots of inside 50s for being a half-back flanker. I'd love to see Ridley and Hurley, who are super intercept marks. They're up near the top of the tree. They're very good intercept one-on-one defenders, but taking those marks around in the logos instead of in their back 50. Deep. So I think when Essendon eventually, hopefully, makes their adjustment with this transition, it plays the game. Just play the game another 40 metres up the ground.
Yeah. Okay. So half as we finish.
Sorry, Warren, you said about the pre-season for the chance for the Bombers to implement this new plan. I am prepared to sit on all new teams and new coaches at clubs a little bit this year because of the situation they've been facing outside the pre-season, where you're training in groups of eight and you can't really address stuff in season because of the protocols you've got to train under. So I'm prepared to sit on them a little bit, the Bombers, but they want to show a fair bit. That would be nice.
I 100% agree with that. Hang on, Ray. So they're 5 wins, 6 losses and a draw. They've got Hawthorn this week. And you think, 6 wins, 6 losses and a draw. But then they go West Coast, Geelong, Port Adelaide. Thanks for coming, season over.
Yeah. They've got some...
That's fair.
I know it's not just the be-all, end-all, the inside mid, but when they find that balance of who their personality is around the midfield, I think Draper's going to be a good ruckman. He's huge, gets his hand on the ball. They'll be able to tidy up. They'll be able to get their field position. The half-back line, like I was mentioning, can get higher, get a little bit more aggressive. I think it can turn quickly for Essendon, but they just need to know what it is they're trying to do.
Just on
that inside mid, I just want to make one more point, because Essendon supporters will sit there and other supporters will sit there and go, well, hang on, Essendon won the clearances 30-27 on the weekend. But the issue with that is the players that are winning the clearances are the ones that you want the ball to be fed out to. After that, you know, you get outside that 2 metre radius of the contest. You want to get the ball to Merritt, to Scheel and those types. So then they're moving away from the stoppage and delivering inside forward 50 rather than those guys right in at the coalface, you know, having to get quick kicks out of a contest. So that's what we're trying to say here, is that use the strengths of Merritt, Scheel, Parrish, etc., with the bigger body midfielder in there. Like, you look at the effect that Tom Liberatore had on the game for the Bulldogs on the weekend, to how he made Lockie Hunter look so much better on Saturday afternoon.
All right, that's the Bombers and the Tigers. Tigers going beautiful. They've got a big Thursday night clash this week, which is going to be excellent. And it's part of round 14. Still got a game to go for round 13, Collingwood North Melbourne, which we might talk about after 8. We're going to keep Jimmy around and headlock him after 8, which will be nice. Whitey?
I want to talk about Tom Lynch, and I want to talk about Vlosten, and I want to talk about Grimes.
We'll do it
now.
Yeah.
Oh, you want to do it now or after the break?
No, do it now. We're going to break into the news today.
All right. So, Jimmy, Vlosten and Grimes particularly need to pull their head in when it comes to staging for free kicks or embellishing contact. This is something that is not new for either of these guys. They've been offered fines. Is this something that they need to actually stamp out of their game, or is it just something that happens in the game?
I think it just happened in the moment. I don't get overly stressed about it. I'm not big on the hunt for players with diving and flopping. We're talking about four free kicks probably in the last 3 weeks. Papley, who got absolutely shoved, his back broken by Frawley. We're talking about Cal Ward, where contact was still high. There's contact still on Nick Vlosten. I'm not sure what Big Belcho was doing, just swinging the arm out there, even though it was minimal. And Grimes, he did get a shove, yeah, so he threw his arms back. I don't like the hunt of players and... sorry, Rabbit. I don't like the hunt. We're talking about four free kicks. Yeah, they had an effect on the game, but, you know, I tend to move on pretty quick from it.
I like the fact that it's being highlighted.
Why? I don't get that. It's just a free kick. Umpires can get it wrong. Players, if that means that any time a player puts his head over the ball and throws his head back, that's no different.
Yeah, I'm not saying that. There's obviously gamesmanship within a game. We all understand how that works, okay? But at the same time, we want our game to be as pure as possible, don't we? So we want those contests. Like, imagine, okay, Jim. Imagine that's a final.
Yeah, but.
But this is what I'm getting at. If that's a final, there's outrage. There is absolute outrage.
I still don't think that justifies. Like we're seeing now, like TV networks, just that's their lead story. Like, come on, we can do better than that.
Yeah, of course we can.
Interesting there, Rammer, about players who throw their heads back in tackles and get free kicks throughout a game. I mean, that happens 15 times a game, I reckon. Players who are getting tackled, they throw their heads back looking for that free kick. Why is that as different as what we saw? Now, I must admit, I'm sort of in Jim's camp. I do like the fact that it's highlighted, and so should the ones where the heads are thrown back too, just by the way, in tackles.
Yeah, agree.
I like the fact it's highlighted, but I'm not going to hang players for instantaneous responses to instance in the game. But they're just things happen in the cut and thrust of it that sometimes you can't even explain yourself when you're doing it.
Alistair Clarkson poured petrol on this whole conversation because of what had happened with Papley. And then, so everyone's now looking for it. And they found it, and there's been some people that have been made example of. But it happens all the time. And Grimes and Vlosten have been doing it forever. Yeah. And there's players across all teams that do it. But Clarkson's the one that's just put petrol on the fire.
The other part to consider, this was the main game of the weekend, the Dreamtime game, most people were watching. So if those two incidents had have happened in the Fremantle and Sydney game, would have they been highlighted? Don't forget, there's times when the AFL want to make examples.
Yeah, but Rama, this is, again, it's happened to Essendon with the Callan Ward situation and now this one. Essendon supporters, and there are some in the media, that they get very emotional because Essendon's not particularly good. And so I reckon there's a lot of angst around Essendon as well from their own supporters, and it's happened to them again. It didn't cost Essendon the game. The Tom Lynch thing, I think, is interesting that Chris O's decided to say to the tribunal, look, you sort him out. I've given him two fines. He doesn't seem to learn. Let's make an example of him so he does learn. I mean, look, he might get a week. I mean, it's not like he's going to get 4 weeks or anything like that. Does Tom Lynch have to change his game, or is he just a victim of circumstances?
Well, I reckon you've got someone trying to break your hand after a broken hand. You're entitled to respond accordingly as well. So there's a fair bit of provocation in that one as well. So I'm a bit more lenient towards Tom on this occasion. He got him a bit high. And I like the system that Chris Oaken say, you know what, I've given him all the fines. You take it and do what you need to do from there. Let him go and defend yourself through that process. I am more than okay with it.
But a little bit of that, and in a way I agree with you, but I also disagree a little bit there, Big Shorts, is I thought our system was set up that every case in isolation. So you can't start stacking them up and going, well, I've seen you plenty of times and I can't do it. I thought you're supposed to be looking at it at a lens of, well, it's just this incident. I can't take into account the last 3 weeks of what you've been up to.
No, but that's the system does allow for that. That's the other part of it. That's in these circumstances when there's three or more, it does come down to the body of work, so to speak, and then you are put in a different scenario. Because clearly you're not learning, the message isn't getting through, is what they're saying through that system. And that's part of the process. It's not part of the box-ticking exercise, but it's part of the tribunal guidelines that's what happens. So all players should be aware of that, and would be, considering certainly what Tom's been involved in from a commentary perspective in the last couple of weeks. What my biggest issue, in fact, I'll bring it up after 8 o'clock. We're going to get to the break here and then into the news with Johnny Bowden. I think there's almost a bigger issue at play. Than players looking to try and get free kicks. So there's a bigger issue of play, which I'll touch on after the break. We'll also have a look at Collingwood North Melbourne tonight. Jimmy's going to hang around because he's a star. He loves Monday mornings. He can't get enough of hanging around after 8. He loves Johnny Bowden's news, and that's what you're going to get after this. Just what I was saying before 8 o'clock, before we move on to Collingwood North, and an important Hawthorn probably going to mention too. My more concern about the way things are going in the game at the moment is not players playing for free kicks. It's the want of the officiators, the umpires, to pay any free kick they can. I think the appetite to pay free kicks that perhaps aren't there, that are less than the 50-50s, less than the Tiki Touchwoods, as they would say in the old days, has increased to a point where they're just looking for a free kick to pay. And if there's any contact anywhere and there's any response, a physical response from a player on the back of any contact, then there's a free kick paid. And I think that it's the wrong way to go about officiating the game, because players start to put themselves in positions where they get contact, be it legitimate or not, and then do the silly salmon and get the free kicks. And then the umpires are playing, and it's, I think, as a quest to keep the ball in motion or to stretch the ground from all the congestion. But I'm not sure it's the answer, but I think it's what's happening. And the reason we're getting players doing what they're doing at the moment with free kick watch is because any contact rammer at the moment is paid a free kick. Even the ones like, you see the down the ground free kicks that are paid for pushes in the back at the moment, where in recent history in the game, they would be paid where the free kick was given, if at all.
That's a big issue in the game.
If at all. But now, if there's a free kick, if you kick the ball, Ram, and I touch your back as you do that, as you kick it, it's going to be 40 metres downfield where the ball was.
Yeah.
Well, it's not a downfield free kick, but it's not even probably a free kick, but they're going to pay the free kick down the field to try and stretch the ground. So I think the appetite to stretch the ground and to look for any contact possible and make it up if you need to is making a real problem for the game.
So a free kick's paid, in your opinion, now, half, to keep the game moving, to stop contests?
To stretch the ground, to keep players away from congestion.
That's a good point. Because I've noticed a lot of those push in the back free kicks as well, after a player's kicked them, which had never been paid in the past, ever. Ever been. It's just, play on, get on with the game and move on.
But they're wrong free kicks. That's actually just not adjudicating the game properly, because if you get pushed in the back as you kick, it's a free kick where the kick took place.
Where
it's not down the field,
exactly.
But it happens all the time.
Yeah, but there's a lot of wrong free kicks being paid at the moment, and I think it's the appetite to keep the ground stretched. That's the only thing I can come up to logically that makes sense.
I said this to you last week, half. I just think it is that there's not enough good umpires around anymore. They've got a real issue with depth at the top end.
That's a bit rough.
I think there is a crisis in quality umpires. And I don't think it's made any easier by the fact that they're doing their reviews on Zoom. They haven't got that connection like they would normally have with the umpiring group of all umpiring together like they have previously. And I just don't think that they're umpiring the game very well. And it's not helped with the changes to interpretations along the way, like they do, but that's the only thing you can put it down to, because when the whistle blows now, it's like rugby union. You've got no idea what the free kick's going to be paid for.
My thing with that, and I've spoken with you guys about this a lot, is I'd like to see actually the physical requirements to be an umpire lowered. I know that sounds strange, but but have you seen the physical benchmarks that umpires, field umpires, have to jump over to be an AFL umpire? You have to be an Olympic qualifying athlete. And we lose a lot of good umpires, experienced umpires, decision makers, or they're out injured. So you want to keep the good ones in the game for longer. But you also just want to attract good decision makers first. Now, we don't need them to... They can't be big and round like our local football umpires when we were kids, when it was someone's dad with their belly hanging out their shirt. But they've got to be fit enough to keep up with the game. But we don't need them running B qualifying times for the Olympics.
No, but I've said this before, Jim. No, but you're right. You're 100% right, but I've said this before. Is that if the AFL needs to revolutionise the way the game is umpired, and if I was in charge of that, I would be saying, right, you're going to have forward 50 umpires, specialised umpires that are former players that are either defenders or forwards who actually understand what holding is, understand what a push in the back is because they've played the game and they get it and they know all the tricks of the trade. They stay inside 50, so they don't have to be particularly fit. And just give good decisions because they're specialised, what would you call it, forward 50 judges. Like in NFL, you actually have a specialised role for the role you play. They've got to do something different because they just keep getting it wrong.
Well, Hawthorn did something different on the weekend, boys, against the Power, the top of the table Power. They ended up losing the game by 10 points. It was a bit more dramatic than that in the third term where the Power sort of seemingly blew the game away a little bit. But they kept fighting, Jim, and there wasn't much in at the end. 10 points the margin with the late goal sealed it for the Power. What did you like from the Hawks' perspective? We know the Power have been good all year, but the Hawks haven't. So let's focus on the positive from the Hawk campaign on the weekend.
Yeah, I like the games from Cousins and Day. I mentioned this before, but geez, Will Day, he looks like an Andrew Mackie clone. He has come from South Australia, so you'd be checking his birth certificate, I think. Will Day, he's got the same body shape. He's got some skills. He's a little bit taller than you think, so I'm seeing a little bit more out of him. I like Cousins playing through the midfield. I thought actually when he was actually as a starting inside mid, I thought Hawthorn had a lot of great effect around the stoppages and the clearances. So he was a big tick. And I think it was more concerning too for Port Adelaide, Hawthorn's ability to score off turnover, but also from their half back line, that continuous flying football. And it's a bit quicker ball movement I've seen from Hawthorn for quite some time. We know traditionally under Clarko half that if they win the ball across half back, they try and pick their way through by kick. But they play with a bit more forward handball, what we've probably seen from the likes of Richmond in recent years, that forward overlapping run. And then the final kick inside forward 50, it was the race back inside forward 50 to get the structure where Hawthorn won a lot of those contests. So they came with a game plan, executed, and I'd like to see a little bit more of that style from Hawthorn.
I'm with you
on that. There's more of a want from Hawthorn to move the ball quicker now than they have in obviously the previous weeks. Obviously, McAvoy was really good in the ruck. I think he had 15 or 16 hit-outs to advantage. So there was, obviously, it's a big plus there. But I'm not seeing Hawthorn now. You know, that chip style that they used to play, chip will hold the football. Port Adelaide had a lot more possession than Hawthorn. Hawthorn are a lot more efficient now with their ball use, which I like because when Hawthorn have been playing at their best, and I'm not talking about their premierships, I'm talking about in recent seasons, they've been efficient with their movement of the ball.
Yeah, and I
are
think
you
sorry,
about Port Adelaide at all?
I think they fell into a bit of a trap early in that game because Hawthorn allowed them, some marks in their back 50. They all sort of thought, well, we're going to fill our boots today, They literally went nowhere with it, especially in the first 5 minutes of the game. At one stage, Port Adelaide had about 35 touches to Hawthorn's 10, but they didn't even get it past their back 50. They were just like, oh, this is great. Yeah, how good is this if you're a half back?
Yeah, no, they did a good job, the Hawks. I think a lot of Hawks fans are pretty happy about that performance on the back of what's happened so far this year, but the Power continue to be the best team in football and sit atop the table.
I don't think they're playing nearly as well as they were earlier in the year, but the key is that they've played a lot of teams that are good. They've got Sydney, North Melbourne, Essendon in their next three, and they finish with Collingwood with a bye in between. So they've banked enough wins, but I don't feel like they're playing the same sort of footy they were earlier in the season. But they're finding a way to win.
Yeah, that's true. It is true. Of course, Geelong beat Adelaide yesterday after a bit of a scare too. Tomah Hawkins sealing that deal late in the game. They're just doing what they have to do at the moment, the Cats, to survive with all this. They're building towards a premiership campaign. What about tonight, Jim? Collingwood and the Kangaroos. What have we got? Mason Cox back in for the Magpies. Still side bottoms last game. What have we got? Six changes for Five Callum, changes for the Magpies, two for the Kangaroos.
Callum Brown omitted, which, I thought he'd shown bits and pieces, but throughout the year. It's just a must-win for Collingwood, isn't it? I know they've got a lot of injuries. A lot of sides have got a lot of injuries, but I think they've just lost a bit of their mojo and flow. Like, I know players do have an impact on that, but I think that the difference for me, the way Collingwood are playing the early part of the year, was there's a lot of trust in their back line, who are super, and their midfield has spread from there. They now have fallen back into that habit they had a couple of years ago, where they all just camp back to the half back line and they rack up huge amount of numbers, but they actually then don't take the ball forward or take the game forward. When they've got their balance right, of they look at, you know, Crisp, I've lost his name, Darcy Moore, and Maynard across half-back, they sort of had a bit of a trust and in those three, win the footy, and then that's when you see them spreading out the midfield group, getting the next one, you know, up through the middle of the ground.
So the Pies have got Carlton and Brisbane in the next 2 weeks, so they just need to find a way tonight. Just find a way, get the win, bank it. It might not look pretty tonight, but just get over the line and do what they possibly can, and to start getting players, back into the team and back into some sort of form. Because they're out of form. But we all know here, Collingwood at their best, they're very good. They are a very good team. Can they get Jeremy Howe back at some stage, potentially before the finals? You know, I saw he was running during the week and starting to move a bit. Still, Sidebottom is going to go home at some stage for the birth of his child, which you should do that, absolutely. But the Pies just need to find a way tonight, half, because Carlton are in good form. Brisbane, obviously, high up on the ladder. So the next 2 weeks will really define where Collingwood are.
Just before you go there, Waddy, I like the inclusion of Roughhead because he allows Darcy Moore to play his natural way. So when you've got the two big key defenders, if you've got one who's like good at intercepting the footy, it's good to have one who plays a little bit closer. So Roughhead in the side allows Darcy to be that sort of freewheeling marking type. I'm not saying they're these type of players, but it's like Barras allows McGovern just to go find the footy. You've got that combination.
Yep. Important combination.
Very
tense. The Pies.
Very tense. Very tense night on the couch for Collingwood supporters, I reckon, half.
I'm with you.
Ooh. I reckon North Melbourne's in this game up to their eyeballs.
Real banana skin game.
Not kneecaps, not shoulders, eyeballs.
Banana skin eyeball game tonight for the Magpies. Absolutely.
I'm not saying they won't win, Collingwood, I tell you what, don't let North Melbourne get a good start.
North Melbourne's effort game was obviously last week against Brisbane. They just failed there. So that was, you know, the acid was on there. The coach, usually after that, there's a bit of a free fall.
Beat Collingwood last year, North.
Tonight. Boys, we need to keep rolling. James, thank you very much for joining us after 8 o'clock. We love your company on a Monday morning. Send the extra invoice to Joe Pignataro. He won't pay it, but send it anyway and see what happens from there. And we look forward to catching up with you next Monday, Jim.
Thanks, guys. Triple time and a half today.